Today is August 3rd, 2015. My name is Christina Varlmack. I'm interviewing for the Arizona State University Gender 2040 Project. Good morning. Could I ask you to say your name and your place of birth?
Absolutely. My name is Michael Hodgins. I was born in Manchester, Connecticut.
So let's talk a little bit about where you grew up and about your family.
Okay. Well, I grew up in Saratoga Springs, New York, and my mom, Patricia, and my dad, Richard Hodgins. We grew up in a horse racing town, Saratoga Springs. So it was a fairly small town at the base of the Adirondack Mountains. And the population went from probably 15,000 people in the winter till maybe quadruple, maybe five times the population in the summertime, when it seemed like all of New York City came up to the horse races. So it was what you call probably a resort town. Which lend itself a lot to hospitality and a lot of jobs for kids, teenagers, that kind of stuff in the restaurant business.
So did you get an early start as a teenager in the restaurant business?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I started at 15 years old. It was my first job, and it was one of those, one of my classmates grabbed me and said, "Hey, you're looking for a job, right?" "Yeah, I am." Brought me into a country club, talked to the chef. Back then, you sat out on the back dock behind the kitchen. You got one of those green milk crates, and you talked about it. He's like, "When can you start?" "Right now." "Great, you're hired." You know, and so I started dishwashing, which was a good job for the time. I think $3.35 was the minimum wage, so I was making big bucks. And I realized really quickly, the big thing that gave me was I realized really quickly how much I hated to do dishes. I absolutely hated it. You know, pot sinks piled up to the ceiling, and, you know, you did everybody else's work, and, you know, when the servers are gone and the cooks are gone, you're still emptying all the garbages, mopping the floors. And so I worked with a bunch of other dishwashers, and my mentor chef would come around, and we'd have really big parties for these seasonal events, and he'd come around and say, "You know, I need 10 boxes or cases of shrimp peeled." And all the other dishwashers would hide and start scrubbing something. And I was like, you know, raise my hand and, you know, get me out of here. I'll be happy. I don't care if it's 10 cases of shrimp. And that's kind of what propelled me into my passion for cooking and food is really just getting out of doing dishes.
Can you tell me who your mentor chef was and why he was important in your kind of evolution?
Yeah. His name was Bob Ketchum. And he was classically trained. I think he went to Paul Smith's in upstate New York. And then he had worked around the circuit in Boston and Rhode Island. So he was very familiar with seafood. And at the time, everything was new to me. So at working at the country club, we had a rotating menu. We had dinners on Fridays and Saturday nights. And every week it was different. So it was quite an education for me. And actually also learning to cook with seasonal foods. And I didn't even know the term seasonal foods back then, but I knew that they went crazy over hand melons, a farm in upstate New York that grew melons. And when the first time I heard we were going to serve it as an appetizer at dinner in a formal dining room, a melon with, you know, like a twist of lime on it or something, no preparation, I thought it was kind of crazy. But when I tasted that melon for the first time, I realized, oh my goodness. Kind of like Alice Waters up in Berkeley with her restaurants, and she says she's more of a procurer of foods than a chef, because if you procure great food and it's fresh and it's you know, the best of what it is, you don't really need to do much with it. Maybe a little sea salt, maybe a little squeeze of, you know, citrus or acid or something. So I learned a lot of stuff about that, and soft shell crabs we worked with, which are a seasonal item. I knew we could only get them for a month. You know, I didn't know why or how. I just knew that everyone went crazy for a month. Or fiddlehead ferns, we could get up there, which is kind of unique to that area in the Northeast. So he really taught me a lot about the business, and I ended up working all through high school and all through my 4 years of college.
And how did you change your view of food through this experience, your first kind of job there?
Well, you know, I kind of grew up as, I would say, a somewhat picky eater, you know, and my parents were both good cooks, But this definitely broadened me to a whole new world of food that I had never experienced before. And, you know, if you can't taste what you're making in the kitchen, you really shouldn't be serving it. So, you know, it was just required to taste a lot of stuff, and I realized how good things could be. And I realized I really had a passion for the business. And most people in the restaurant business will tell you, if you don't have a passion, you're probably crazy to stay in the business, or you're a little bit of both, passionate and crazy, which might be closer to me.
So let's talk about, you said you worked at this establishment during college.
Yes.
So did your likes change? Did you take a different interest in food and how to prep the preparation and everything? Or?
Well, I went to college at the University at Albany, SUNY State University of New York at Albany, and actually got my bachelor's degree in history with a minor in anthropology. But I continued to work, you know, and even through those 4 years, I really knew, I think by junior year, that I really wanted to stay in the food business. And I had a talk from my mom, who sat me down, even at 21 years old or whatever, saying, "You have 3 years under your belt. You don't know how hard it may be to go back to school. Please promise me you'll finish this last year." So I listened to my mother, which I didn't always do growing up, but I listened to her there, and I appreciate it now. And I knew my junior year I was probably going to move out to Scottsdale to go to Scottsdale Culinary Institute, which is now Le Cordon Bleu. And so I finished the last year, and that's kind of what took me out west.
So why was it important for that your mom told you you had to finish? Why was that important to her and for you?
Well, I think it certainly opened doors in my career that I wouldn't have had otherwise, as far as working at an educational institution as I do now. And she just knew, which I know now and wouldn't have known then, that you get busy. You know, families come up. You know, I have a 10-year-old son, Justin, and a 8-year-old daughter, Gabriella. And so many things come up in life that it's so easy to just say it's not possible to go back and get your bachelor's degree. It could be daunting to have to do that. So I'm really glad that I did it.
And how on graduation day, how excited were your parents and yourself that you had completed your degree? And can you?
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, very ecstatic, I guess. You know, she was definitely relieved because she thought for a minute I was just going to pack up the car and drive out west. And, you know, I was happy as well.
And why did you choose Scottsdale? What was appealing for you to go to the school, the culinary school there?
The appeal, I think it was dual-fold. One, I had a little bit of family out here. My grandparents, June and Albert, lived out in Sun City. And I also had an uncle, Bill, and an Aunt Beth that lived in Paradise Valley at the time. So it was moving cross-country at a young age, but there was some family. Also, it had a good reputation as a school, and it had an intensive associate's degree at the time. And I had just come off four years of college and wasn't looking to get into. And ironically, I grew up about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of Hyde Park, where the Culinary Institute of America is one of the most famous culinary schools in the country. But that was a two and a half year program. It was very expensive. So it just made sense. And to be honest with you, I took a trip out to visit the school, and my aunt was teaching some law classes here at ASU, and she took me around the campus, and, you know, it was the middle of February. I barely got off the ground in New York with the snow on the wings, and I walked around, and there's people out here in bathing suits and shorts and, you know, playing soccer and volleyball, and I think that helped.
So tell me a little bit about your experience of in the Scottsdale Culinary School, what that was like for you, kind of the different...
You know, it was a great experience because I had worked in the business at that point for about 6 years. However, I knew how to make a hollandaise sauce. I knew how to make, you know, I knew how to do a lot of things at that point, but I didn't know why. You know, I didn't know why a hollandaise or a Caesar dressing holds together. I didn't know you need protein. You need acid. I knew you had to put lemon and you had to put egg yolks in there and you had to slowly drizzle your fat to emulsify, but I didn't know the why behind a lot of that stuff. A lot of stuff in the baking and that kind of stuff, which is a little bit more of an exact science. I kind of learned the whys and the hows. So, I mean, my experience level gave me, I think I might have learned more because I wasn't a deer in the headlights coming into it. But they taught me a lot of good things, and I'm really glad. You know, can you become a great chef without culinary school? You know, it's possible by putting in a lot of years. But the combination of the experience and the school, I think, is the best of both worlds.
What do you think was the most memorable moment of your time in the school?
Most memorable moment. I think we had a catering class where we would do grand buffet. And the whole school ate the grand buffet. Well, ate the buffet every day. So the night school people would come in early, and the people going during the day would come in, or it would be right after their classes, and everyone would get together for a huge like community meal every day, which was pretty cool. And for our grand buffet, every 3 or 4 weeks, a class would do a grand buffet. And we did, I think, a New Orleans theme, and we had, you know, crawdads and Mardi Gras music going on, and, you know, all this stuff. And it was just, it was pretty awesome to have the whole school basically looking at you like, wow, this is good stuff. And it brings, you know, it brings everyone together, you know, so it's kind of a community focused time. Yeah.
And how was culinary school different from getting your college degree?
When I finished culinary school,
mm-hmm.
It was good. You know, it was kind of, I was happy to be done, and I was ready to just get, you know, cause when I got my 4-year degree, I didn't work quite as much, but I worked throughout a lot of it. During culinary school, I worked 40 hours a week, so I was kind of happy, not going to lie, I was kind of happy it was done because I was working 40 hours a week and going 8 hours a day, 5 days a week to school. But then, you know, the coming off of getting a bachelor's degree and writing 20-page research papers versus the work level associated with the associate of the culinary degree seemed a little easier for me, so...
Did you know that this was the right direction when you chose after you
finished? I did. And going back to my mom, I think she was a little bit nervous. You know, I think she was thinking, well, do you really want to do this? Or is this just a passing phase, you know, where, yeah, you're really into culinary. And then 2-3 years later, you're going to want to do something else. But I graduated culinary school in 95. So I think we're 20 years in. I don't think it was a passing phase.
So let's talk a little bit about... how you became interested in sustainable agriculture.
Okay. I would say my main interest came from working from a company called Bon Appetit Management Company, BAMCO. And their whole tagline, their culture was really, I mean, they walked the walk about sustainable food service, which was great. So I would say they got me into it. But before that, I was working up in the East Bay, and I lived in San Leandro. I was working in Oakland, and my wife and I would take the BART train into the city. The first time we showed up at the Ferry Building Farmers Market on Pier 1, we were just absolutely blown away. Probably 200 farms there. It wrapped from in front of this ferry building around the backside, and then as far as you could go before people... You know, they were right on the edge of the bay, on the water. Like, you push back a booth, they would be swimming. And, I mean, it had fresh, shocked oysters. It had, I mean, when it was peach season or plum season, they would have, every single farm would have little wedges sampled up at their table. So we made a huge mistake the first time, right? Because we bought stuff from, like, the vendors in front. We didn't even know there was the back or the side. And they were good. It wasn't nothing wrong with it. But every time we would have another peach or another, wow, this is even better. Same thing with tomatoes. I mean, they would have them sliced up. And we thought we had the best tomatoes we ever tasted till we got around the back. And so then we realized really quickly that, okay, we need to do a loop around here. But so tasting that really, you know, really local, really fresh food really kind of stimulated it. And then fast forward... a year or so, we had end up moving back to the Valley here to work where I was the executive chef at Intel for the Bon Appetit Management Company. And when I walked into that position, so I knew their culture, but they didn't have a very big infrastructure in Arizona at the time, only a couple small accounts. So they said, we want you ordering from, you know, local vendors, small farmers, you can do it. And I was, you know, said, okay, so... you have any leads or numbers or, well, no, not really. So That was in 2005. So that's kind of when I set out to, you know, I said, well, okay, I met Pamela Hamilton from Edible Phoenix, who was a good resource. But I really just started going to farmers markets and talking to vendors and saying, here's what we're doing. And luckily at that, we had 7 cafes on 2 campuses there. So we had the ability to really buy some volume, which was good and bad. It was great for the farmers, but a lot of them couldn't keep up with the supply of the stuff we needed. We ended up working out a deal with Cricket Sky Farms at the time to do a restaurant-style CSA, community-supported agriculture, where you would pay for a weekly share, or you'd pay up front for a quarter, and then they'd bring you weekly shares. And we did that restaurant style, which, you know, has its ups and its downs, but it was great because we were able to change our menu weekly as to what specials we did. So we would get a bag in, and or, you know, several bags, you know, probably a couple $100 for each kitchen worth of produce, and we would write our menus based on what we were getting in. So.
And so let's talk about when you first started in 2005 and kind of there being no infrastructure. And how did you sell this, or how did you convince local farmers that, you know, and just how did you build the infrastructure?
Yeah, some of them I couldn't. Some of them, you know, said, I've sold to restaurants in the past and you chefs are a pain in the, you know, we'll keep it PG. But some of them were interested in it. Some of them, I had to make a lot of concessions that I might not have made through a more established produce company. There was a lot of late minute, you know, cancellations or calls that, hey, I know you needed those 40 pounds of this, but we only have 20. So I would say, you know, going to farmers markets, talking to the farmers, going out to see their farms, you know, having conversations with them, you know, like, hey, I understand. It's basically trying to get the chef and the farmer together, because we both have our issues, you know. For farmers, a lot of it's distribution is a big issue for them. And they have the product, but they don't have the means to get it out. And we're talking about very perishable stuff, you know. So it needs to move. And if they have a bumper crop, they need to move it or it's going to be plowed under. So I tried to work with them from a distribution standpoint and be flexible as I could. And, you know, they also had to know they couldn't come in at noon with an order when the kitchen's crazy and everyone's trying to keep up with the lunch rush and they're standing back there, hey, you guys going to check in my order or what, you know? Something else I worked out with a few farmers, Maya from Maya's Farm at one point, Michael Thompson from Love Grows Farm, which is actually no longer in existence, but we worked it out where they would deliver food and then they would take our compost, food scraps, back with them. So it was just one trip. They would drop out the food, we would throw they would take our compost, and it worked out real good.
Tell me why farmers markets are so important to the community.
Well, farmers markets are real important to the community because they connect the farms and the farmers to the people. You know, you can put a face to the food you're eating, and you know, I think that's important because it's something that's been lost over time, and we're getting, you know, society is getting more and more and more disconnected from their food source. You know, I go in and talk to elementary school kids, and you know, I think some of them think a chicken nugget comes from a mama chicken nugget. You know, I mean, they don't even put it together with it's this, you know, animal running around and has feathers on it. That's not a, no, it's a, you know, there's a real disconnect. And I think education is so important. I mean, I would love to see curriculum in elementary schools right up through high school of, you know, implementing gardening, cooking, you know, especially cooking, because a lot of people just don't know what to, you know, you can go to a farmer's market, that's all well and good, and, you know, they may be having huge amounts of kale or Swiss chard or different greens, you know, but if you're not going to buy it if you look at it and say, I have no idea what to do with that, right? So, I mean, I think the education on basic cooking essentials, gardening, can connecting them with food. I mean, the gardening part and the even the ranching or raising chickens or some, you know, for eggs, something simple like that, for people to see what actually goes in to that, you know, and the time. You know, when you plant a seed and you finally get something, 90 days, 120 years, 4 months later, and all the tending and the watering and that went into that, there's a whole new appreciation for the value of food.
So you mentioned the curriculum and going into schools. Why is that important to kind of engage the younger generation to for the gardening and the cooking? Why is that important?
I think it's important because it connects them to what food is and the different varieties of food and the diversity of food that's out there. The diversity is being lost. We're not preserving local stuff. We're not preserving heirloom varieties of stuff. A cucumber comes in many, many different forms and shapes. You know, the Armenian cucumber grows great out here, and it's a giant, you know, cucumber. But most people, if they even know what a cucumber looks like whole, kids, it's just the waxy, regular, genetically modified or hybrid to be that, you know, so that, because food is grown right now basically so it can ship. I mean, that's the genetic traits that most companies want, right? They want to grow it so that it holds up well so you can ship it, and it can, 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later, you can put it in your fridge and it's still good, but you're losing flavor, you're losing all kinds of diversity. And I think, you know, if I go in and hold up a beet or a fig in a classroom of elementary school kids, there might be one or two kids out of 30 that know what they are. And that's kind of scary to me. So I think just even introducing, whether they're going to like them or not at that time, you know, I know myself, I wouldn't eat a beet at 8 years old. I probably had to try it. I think that was part of the thing. But I can understand stronger flavors, and you develop taste as you get older. But I think just planting the seed, no pun intended, of showing them this kind of stuff and showing them gardening and what it actually means. And it's a life skill too, you know. It's a life skill. 'Cause food is obviously one of the things that we need.
So you mentioned the community when they sit down at the dinner, and that's important. Can you talk a little bit about that community that comes together when they sit around a table? Because I've heard that theme throughout the interviews that I've done.
Yeah, I think food, I mean, the bottom line is food brings people together. And it brings, you know, if you have people over your house and you entertain, food is always a central theme. I like the fact that in Europe and other countries, food is considered the plan for the evening, right? So the meal is the plan, whereas here it's like, okay, what are we going to grab before we go out to the movies or to the, you know, in Europe it's more like we're going to have a 3-hour dinner and, you know, not going to eat any more food really. It's just going to be paced out and we're going to have fun and talk and enjoy each other's company. And I think it's just a common bond that connects a lot of us. And it's a great time to really just breathe and talk. And I don't think, you know, we do enough talking. You know, it seems like more of a, you know, you drive into your garage, you close your garage, you walk into the house, you get in your car, you open your garage, you go back to work. And it's not like, you know, I'm sounding old or dating myself right now, but I mean, it's not like when we grew up, all the neighbors were out in the front porches, the front yards, and you know, seemed like there was a much more connected interaction now. And I think when you can sit people down around a table to eat good, wholesome food, that there's just kind of a bond.
Okay, so I'm going to go back to talk about when you first arrived in 2005, and you said there was no connection to local farmers, and they were not supporting what was grown here locally. How did that movement change, or how did you help that movement change?
Well, I think it was unique for what we were doing with the type of company I was working for. working as a corporate dining facility. There was people obviously in that movement supporting local farmers, but they were mainly mom and pop type restaurants. And it's a challenge for a lot of operations that don't charge the price points of a more, you know, for a more fine dining restaurant, you know, I can get $15 for a nice beet and goat cheese salad. Whereas if I'm working at a corporate dining facility serving lunch, you know, my price point's going to be a lot lower. So it becomes a challenge. But I think just the fact that we started doing that and we started educating our consumers, and that's a huge part of it. Because you could be serving great local beets and your customers might realize the fact that they're great tasting. But I think it's important that you market and let people know what you're serving, because that gets them thinking, oh, wow, we can get this. You know, a lot of people wouldn't even consider the fact that that could have even been grown in Arizona. I know I didn't when I moved out here. When my company asked me to start making connections, I was looking around at the saguaro cactuses and going, all right, I don't see anything growing out here. But Yuma's the food hub for the winter for the United States as far as lettuces and produce. So as soon as Northern California shuts off in the wintertime, Yuma picks it up. So we do grow, you know, that's 3 hours away from here, but we grow a lot of food in the state of Arizona. And then there's a lot of, I would say the number of local farms since we first started has probably quadrupled. So there's a lot more people doing it, but it's a hard business. It really is. And you don't benefit, obviously, from economies of scale like the big monoculture farms do. So there's barriers as far as price being probably one of the biggest barriers. And the education, going back to the education of people to realize, you know, this is worth this, you know, that's the hard part. When we live in a dollar menu society, when the federal government's subsidizing monoculture, large conglomerates and corn and wheat production and all of this, it's because you can't make a chicken sandwich for a dollar. You just cannot make a chicken sandwich and not go out of business. So you either have to be using not chicken and a lot of products that are subsidized like corn. So you got corn syrup in there and you got all kinds of layers of filler. And then the bun is made with, you know, corn syrup and subsidized wheat. But so the value, I think people, it has to become a priority. And right now I don't think it is for the majority of people. And I can understand that because, you know, some people just, if you're choosing between filling your kids' bellies with calories and being able to get out and get nutritious food, it's a struggle.
So I hear you talk a lot about business in the background. Mm-hmm. Has that become a major kind of player in your role at Intel? Were the business skills kind of, did you need to acquire quickly the business set?
Oh, absolutely. As well? Absolutely.
Can you talk about that? Because usually when you think of chef, you think of just food and
just creative. Just
creative, and you get to taste, but they don't talk about the business skills. And I hear that coming
from you. Oh, yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, a business has to, at the very least, break even. You know, if you're losing money, you're not going to be a business very long. So, especially with the bigger the operation, as executive chef of a place with 7 different outlets, I didn't do a lot of hands-on cooking. I mean, I did, but my role was more of an executive type role where, making sure that our labor costs were in line, that our food purchasing costs were in line. And that's hard when you're getting a, you know, weekly conference call telling you, you know, you're 3 percentage points high on your food cost, but yet you want me to buy food that's cost more, you know, and short term costs, you know, are more. The long term costs are much better for our environment, better for people's nutrition. So there's a big difference between the short term and the long term costs. But when you're on a weekly conference call, it's short term costs that they're talking about. But yet, I felt fortunate to work for a company that did care that much about serving food. We had an Eat Local challenge every year there, where we would try to make the whole entire cafe from within 150 miles, all the products in there. We had a low carbon diet day, so serving low carbon footprint stuff. So we pulled our burgers from the grill that day. We did some stuff. The only thing that I got the 911 call from was in California, because our company was doing several Intel properties. In California, one of the properties pulled the cream for the coffee, because beef cattle is highly has a high carbon footprint, right? So they pulled the cream for the coffee, and you do not mess with people's coffee. That was the get the phone call. You guys serving cream? Yeah. Oh, okay, good. Do not pull the cream. They're about to riot for their morning coffee, which I don't blame them. But we got to do a lot of really good stuff, and I really was educated quite a bit into what sustainability in the food system means from a multifaceted perspective. I mean, from where you're sourcing it from, you know, how you're preparing it, and how are you disposing it. So are we completing the whole circle of food? Yeah.
So let's ask you, since you brought that up, how would you define food sustainability?
I think sustainability in general, food sustainability, is just allowing future generations to grow and eat and provide for themselves wholesome food like our current generation can, and without jeopardizing them, you know, eating and providing people with food without jeopardizing future generations from being able to do the same for their families.
Now, you mentioned the full circle. Can you talk a little bit about what that full circle is?
Yeah, and that's something we teach at Rio Salado College in our sustainability program in our food sustainability program. Is the full circle would be from planting that seed or raising that animal to how to do that without hurting the environment, how to do that organically, how to add things to the soil, natural things, how to use different kind of plantings, trap crops. So I might plant mint next to my peppers because I want all the insects to have a party on the mint and not eat my peppers, you know. Intercropping, which is the opposite of large monocultures, whereas pests can't come in and get too comfortable because they don't have, I mean, as our gardener Josh puts it, in Iowa, if you're a bug that likes corn, you know, you're going to signal for your whole family and everybody to move in, right? And you're never going to leave because you have an endless food source. And that's why they have to spray so many pesticides on those big monoculture fields, because there's nothing to dissuade the insects from coming. They have endless, you know, so we employ all kinds of different techniques to grow naturally like that. And then the students would harvest the food, bring it into the kitchen, show them different ways to prepare it, talk about, you know, healthy cooking techniques, and then what happens with, you know, your trimmings or your coffee grounds or your eggshells. What do we do with those and how we get them back into the compost at our garden, which gets back into the bed. We get wood chips donated, or even some of our on-site landscapers will chip trees up, and they'll bring them to the garden, and then that will just go in right with our food scraps to generate soil to grow healthy food again. And you're really looking at, you know, I wouldn't say it's 100% zero waste. I'm not sure we'll ever get there, but it's very little waste because you're just completing that whole cycle and you're going right back into growing more food.
So let's talk a little bit about Rio Soldado.
Rio Salado College.
Thank you, sorry. How did you get involved with this organization?
I got involved initially as an advisory board member for the program, the Sustainable Foods Program, that was newly a new program that they formed a bunch of community members that were actively working in the community with sustainable foods. And I had hoped to teach for them as an adjunct teacher, and then continued to do what I was doing. And one thing led to another, and I actually ended up starting the program with a blank slate, basically, to kind of a dual role to oversee the cafe, kind of a general management type of oversight of the cafe and the catering programs, and then also make sure that all our we're primarily an online school. However, we have a culinary cooking class, we have a baking class, the gardening class, which all are what we consider hybrids. So the students take their didactic portion of the course online, and then they come in and do their lab or clinical portion in the kitchens or the garden.
So tell me what your goals and your mission are for the school, for the culinary section.
For the sustainable foods program, I'd say the goals and the mission are to create a sustainably minded workforce. You know, we're an occupational program, and we want to empower students to have that knowledge to go out there and get into the industry. And even if, you know, a lot of them won't necessarily open their own restaurants or go completely farm to table type of thing, but even no matter where they go, we want them to know that there are other options than just finding one broad, what we call a broadliner provider, that will give you everything from bleach to ground beef, you know. And that's the easier way. I mean, I'm gonna be honest with you. That's the easier way. If you can do one order, boom, you know, from your bleach to your burger to your broom to your, and then hit send, and it all shows up on a giant, you know, semi the next day. And we still use broadliner companies. You know, I mean, we need to get products from them, and I'm not completely anti that. But there's so many local farms here and places that raise pork here locally. Beef within the state, you know, ground beef, that kind of stuff. Many local farms throughout the area. That to integrate those, it's very doable, and it's not that much harder, and it never feels wrong. You know, it always feels like you're doing the right thing, and the taste is awesome. But the relationships too, the relationships that you form with these farmers and these ranchers, you know, are pretty amazing, I think. So I guess the mission is really to create a new workforce and a new way of thinking amongst them. And even if they can't, you know, they're not going to be able to change the world in a lot of their companies where they're going to have kind of set specs of what they do. But even if they can infuse, you know, this, or, hey, can we start working with this company a little bit? I think it's, for me, sustainability is not either here or there, you know, one end of the spectrum or the other. It's not all or nothing. I think you want to be moving at all times towards, you know, becoming more sustainable. But I think if you look at it as an all or nothing approach, for me, I think people get defeated very easily and think, well, we can't do it because this is too expensive. But what little baby steps can you do to slowly increase the sustainability of your restaurant or eating at home, you know, your home eating, same thing. You know, can you plant something in your backyard? Doesn't have to be a full production, you know, huge garden, but, you know, or some fruit trees or, you know, lettuce, Swiss chard, that stuff grows like amazingly here. You know, can you put in just a little bed in one little area, a little raised bed or something, and every night you have salad that you can go clip. And for me, I have a garden in my backyard, and there's nothing cooler than going out there and grabbing, you know, whether it's dinner or whether it's a side to the dinner. I mean, it's beautiful.
Tell me the difference between growing it locally or having access to it locally, the local flavor, versus shipping it hundreds of miles away. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is it could be summed up in, you know, the word fresh, I guess, but nutrition is a huge part of it. And food that's picked, food nutrients degrade rather quickly as soon as something's picked. They just start going downhill. And if you can pick something, I mean, in a perfect scenario, like I'm talking about going out in my backyard and clipping arugula like 15 minutes before dinner, I mean, that is packed. You're going to have all the nutrients that thing can offer you. And when it's picked and shipped, you know, once again, it's probably going to be picked underripe, depending on what it is. If it's like it's a tomato, it's going to be picked green, and it's going to be shipped and then gassed to turn, I won't even call it red, or refuse to call it red. I think it's like a pink color they become in the supermarket. But they don't have flavor either. When you let something grow on a vine and ripen right there, pick it and serve it, you're going to develop all the sugars, all the intricacies, the flavors are going to be developed and ready to eat. When you ship something, not only is it losing its nutrient value, but it's losing flavor, not losing flavor, but it never fully developed that flavor.
So tell me a little bit about what is the most satisfying aspect of your work at Real Soldado.
Soldado.
I just can't get that. I'm just going to give you a G in there. I don't care if you don't have one. I'm just giving it to you.
You can go with Rio. That works fine.
Let's go with Rio. Thank you.
I think the most satisfying thing is, working with the students and the staff and the community members that come in to the Cafe at Rio, to be able to once again show them there's a different way than just a foil wrapped burger, and to really show them a large variety of what we can do here with local foods and what grows here. We have an on-site garden that we also harvest quite a bit of what we use in the cafe. And to show them, people will come in and they'll say, you didn't grow that here. Yeah. And our garden's open, for anyone to walk around at any time. But just to educate the community is the most satisfying. And obviously the students, but everyone that comes in there to just kind of talk and tell our story about, what we're trying to do and how it's possible to do that. And do it in your own. A lot of people go back and they'll come in, they're like, hey, I went to the farmer's market, last week, or I planted this, and we'll tell people, because they'll say, well, I can't grow anything. And trust me, I had a black thumb when I first started planting gardens, and it's just a little bit of know-how. And that's kind of what we give them in our program, but we'll also do the same thing if someone just comes in the cafe and they're asking us questions. I'll take them out to the garden and I'll show them stuff. They'll talk with Josh Sundberg, our gardener, about his philosophy of growing things and how to do it, because it's very intimidating when you come from the Midwest, when you come from even upstate New York. It seemed like we could throw seeds in and it just, you get all the rain and things grow. And it's intimidating to see this clay soil that you can't even put a shovel through, You're like you're digging for gold with a pick just to get a little dirt in, but you can grow a lot of stuff here. It's just you need the right, amendments, and you need to build the soil a little bit. But compared to a lot of the country that's under snow for a majority of the year, we can grow a lot of food here.
Let's talk about the gardening class that you have at Rio, and mm-hmm. how that started and why that was important to implement in the program.
Sure. And that started as basically when we were putting together the curriculum for the Sustainable Foods Program. And we thought it was important for if we were going to talk about this full circle, to show students, what it took to grow something and how important that is. And once again, like I talked about earlier, the appreciation of what went into, if you're eating a burger or whatever you're eating, that I would say many of us, including myself at many times, would take that slice of onion or that slice of tomato on that burger for granted, But when you actually get in there and you plant it and you see it grow and everything that went into you finally pick that beautiful tomato, it's almost like you don't want to eat it, Wow. But yet, I don't think there's an appreciation out there for what that really takes and what the value of that should be. It's not going to be, it takes time and money to grow something that's that good and that flavorful.
What is your students' reaction when they do the gardening class and they start and how?
I'd say it's probably one of the favorite classes in the program. Most of them really enjoy. I think there's something about, now if they were taking it in August or something, they might not enjoy it quite as much, but we tend to run them in the later fall and earlier spring. I think it's just something about being out in nature that lets people kind of breathe, and working with your hands to see that. So it's a favorite class of many of the students.
So let's talk a little bit about, you said the full circle and the compost bin. Are there things that you, why is that last feature important? Because people mainly are talking about growing, but they're not talking about the full circle.
Sure.
Why is that last component important to the full circle?
Right. Well, for a couple of reasons. One, if all those food scraps are going in the landfill, they're going to compost anaerobically. They're going to be buried in layers and layers of food. So they will break down, but they're going to break down anaerobically, which means they're going to be emitting methane gases, which we know is not good for the environment. The other part of that is it's going to provide a natural fertilizer for our garden to grow the next generation of things. And if we don't have that, then we're going to have to bring in, the plants need to eat just like you and I do. So they need to have some kind of nutrition, and they're not going to get it just if you just keep growing food. Eventually what's in the soil is going to be depleted, so you need to add something back to it. So it's either going to be Miracle-Gro or some kind of purchased fertilizer, which we don't think is as good. You know, it's chemically derived, it takes a lot of petroleum and other things to produce it. So we get a dual benefit from it. We're not adding any extra greenhouse gases, and we have a free supply of fertilizer, basically, to help our next generation of plants go and just continue around that circle.
Okay, can you tell me why do you think food sustainability is important? Just kind of the overall.
Overall, I think it's important just because kind of when I referred to my definition earlier about the fact that, you know, I want us all to be nourished well, but I also don't want to jeopardize future generations from being able to nourish them and my family, my grandkids' kids. I want them to be able to eat the same healthy foods that we're able to eat and not, you know, a lot of the practices now really do a lot to deplete the earth, you know.
Do you have any concerns over industry's power within the food system itself?
Yes. Yeah, I think there's a lot of, a few major conglomerates and big, you know, corporations that are more and more controlling the food system, from seed to fertilizer, putting patents on stuff, you know, Terminator seeds that will grow for one generation and then you can't harvest the seeds from the plants. And that stuff, you know, genetically modified foods are obviously huge right now. And then a lot of it is a lot of these seeds can blow from, you know, a field that is a patented field into a field that's not, and basically show the same characteristics. And next thing you know, you have companies coming after Farmer B, because Farmer A cross-pollinated his crops, and all of a sudden he can't save the seeds, or he has a company coming to him with a lawsuit saying, you didn't pay for this technology. It's becoming very, very, it's like something about patenting food that just doesn't sit easy with me.
Tell me, can you explain to people that don't understand what is genetically modified food, and why should people be aware that their food is in that?
Yeah, well, genetically modified is taking genes from, you know, one food, animal, whatever. You could take fish genes and put it in corn, or it's you know, playing a lot with our crops, and we really don't know the long-term effects that we'll have on human health, I think is one of the scariest things about it. And I think a lot of the people, even if they're against it, they want to at least be able to be aware that their food and, you know, food labeling is very, very big right now. There's a lot going on with that in the government. And, yeah, I think it's just the fact that we really don't know. And I think it's being sold to the public as, you know, we'll never have enough food to feed the millions or billions if we don't use genetically modified foods. But there's also a huge distribution problem in the country. There's a lot of food waste. There's a lot of stuff that gets, you know, plowed under. You look at most studies, there's enough food in the world. It's just the distribution of it and the equity of distribution of it too.
Can you elaborate a little bit more about the food distribution issue that there is and what that entails and what
it's getting food from point A to point B, really. I mean, in the simplest terms, I mean, we have food coming in from Mexico at the border that, you know, companies will go through it, and if it doesn't meet, you know, the grade A or grade B standards, if they can sell it in the supermarket or the market, or it's off, you know, has an awful look or whatever, they'll rot in piles. I mean, and this is wholesome food, but it just doesn't meet the standards. There's some companies that actually go down there and get that food and do, I think Market on the Move is one of them, and some different companies that try to get that food out there. But there's a lot of farmers that don't have, you know, smaller farmers that don't have resources to get the food out there. So much food is so perishable that it really takes a very organized system to make sure it's getting to the right people. And then the retail, like the end user, is a big thing too, because we have food deserts out there, and we have areas of where people don't have access to the food. The food's there, it's being grown, but it's not getting, you know, there's either not stores in the area, people don't have transportation, very low income, so they're back to the, you know, the dollar menu thing. You know, do I want to get some calories in my kids' bellies, or do I want to get on a bus and go around town looking for fresh food? So I think that's one of the things we need to work on in the future, definitely, is access to fresh food, and access to fresh food in a manner where it's not price restrictive, you know, is a big thing. And it's more available, as far as, you know, if I have one farmer market in my area and it's on Saturday from 7 to noon, and I work Saturday from 7 to noon, I'm out of luck, you know. So it's access is I think one of the biggest things as far as food, you know, justice that we have to really, really work on.
Can you talk a little bit about, I know you've kind of covered this, but we're just going to kind of recap what the challenges are to food sustainability?
I think there's a lot of people that want to produce food in a sustainable manner, but I think some of the difficulties are the fact that they're generally smaller scale operations. They're not working on economies of scale. They're not beating the land up, so they're not putting a ton of extra fertilizers and pesticides to grow the, you know, the biggest output in the smallest amount of land. So they have to charge more to stay in business. And I think price is, you know, when it comes down to the bottom line, it's one of the biggest things for whether it be a restaurateur or a consumer at a farmer's market. You know, that to me is the number one challenge, is to be able to somehow, and I think that comes with working with the federal government and working with subsidies. I mean, we're incentivizing the growing of the corn and the wheat, and you know, we have corn syrup and everything. Well, I wonder why, right? I mean, it's corn syrup developed because farmers had nothing to do with all this corn. You know, they had no more outlets for it. Well, what else can we do with all this extra corn that's sitting here? So they came up with different outlets for it. And when you subsidize something, it becomes so cheap and becomes a filler in all of our food, it's just a backward system, I believe. I think if we could start subsidizing the smaller growers, the people that are growing sustainably, and, you know, make that a cheaper alternative, I think it would, you know, the long-term effects of that would be outstanding on human health, nutrition. You know, nutrient-dense food is, you know, in my opinion, the best thing to eat. But once again, if it's that versus calories, and you have to make that choice, and you don't have access, you don't have education. That's right back to, you know, getting the education early on. Cycles of families, you know, well, this is how we ate, and this is how mom did, and, you know, we got this, and we went and got a burger this night, and Kentucky Fried this night. And, you know, my kids, They brought home last year, I think, or 2 years ago, one of the big fundraisers for their elementary school was a coupon book, you know, as you might have seen. And I'm not even kidding. The first, I think, 23 pages were McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Burger King, Wendy's. Now, I'm not some saint that doesn't ever eat fast food, and, you know, we like our In-N-Out burgers from time to time and our, you know, our other things. But, I mean, we're wondering why we have an obesity epidemic, and the main fundraiser is sending home, and you want to buy the, like, I bought it and didn't take the book. I just said, here's the $20 or whatever. But that's an incentive, whether, you know, for parents to go do that, you know. Well, we got 2-for-1 here, and it's all the first 22 pages. And I don't know it's not a simple answer. I wish I could just say, well, let's just do this, this, and this. But, you know, their answer to me when I talked to the PTA president, who happened to be my neighbor, which I didn't realize at the time, it was very awkward the way that unfolded. She was like, oh, hi, Michael. I'm like, oh, man, wish I knew that before I wrote this email. But, you know, she's like, hey, it's the biggest fundraiser we have for the year. And, you know, I didn't have an alternative to that. So, it's a big fundraiser, but it was 20 something pages of everything fast food. And, I don't know.
Okay. Can you talk, what should the food system in Phoenix look like in 2040?
Well, what would I hope? Because if I knew the answer to doing that, you know, there's a lot of people that wish they had the answer to that. But I would like to see it more regionalized, definitely. And I think whether it be co-ops or some kind of distribution centers that could help the smaller farmers get their product to market, so they could spend more time doing what they know how to do, which is grow food, and less time running around in vans trying to sell it before it goes bad. I think that would be very helpful. But definitely, I'd like to see it structured more where we're more self-supportive and we're preserving traditions too, and preserving plants, you know, like tepary beans, or, I mean, you can get a lot of great food here. Cactus, prickly pear, you know, using more things that grow here for years, and even things that maybe haven't grown here for years, you know, but things that grow well here, and they're not resource intensive, you know, fig trees, things like that that just grow, you know, pomegranates, they grow amazingly well here. They don't need a ton of water. Let's, you know, integrate more of those. We went down to Dateland, Arizona, which grows dates. I'm sure that's a shocker, but, and they have dates everywhere, and they're delicious. They make date milkshakes, and we took a trip down there with my staff to Blue Sky Farms, who was there at the time, that had just this organic farm in the middle of the desert. It was just a complete oasis. But really using, you know, mesquite flour, keeping alive some of these traditions of foods that have sustained people for years and years.
So you've mentioned two organic farms that have already, seems like they've gone under, saying that they were there.
Actually, Blue Skies is still a farm, but okay. they've moved back to the valley.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So I was going to ask, well then...
But the Love Grows Farms, yes, is no longer existing. And small farming is a risky business. I would say it's comparable to the restaurant business, which is another very risky business. And it's almost like they're not playing on an even playing field. You know, when you open a small farm or you open a small restaurant, your competition is big. It's big ag, it's big corporations, you know. You go to a mom-and-pop restaurant in the summer here in Arizona on a Tuesday night, you might see like two other tables in there. You go to Cheesecake Factory, and during the recession, on a Tuesday night in the summer, which is our off-season, and there's a wait at the door. So, I mean, I don't know the answer.
What policy changes would you think would help towards a more sustainable food system in 2040?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big one would be to completely relook at what we're doing with subsidies. in the federal government, and giving the smaller farmers more of an advantage. Because quite honestly, the big monoculture, big agriculture, huge companies have a huge advantage with all the government subsidies they get. And that puts, once again, it puts the whole, I think it puts, it devalues food in the fact that consumers think that food only costs that much to grow and that's what it's worth. And then you have somebody that's growing it on a smaller scale, not getting subsidies, growing it sustainably, looking towards future generations, and they have to charge more. But yet, I think the perception, the consumer perception is that, well, that's too much. So we need to make a priority. I think food, good food, real food, wholesome food, needs to be more of a priority. And folks 20 years ago didn't have an extra $70 in their budget to pay for a cell phone bill. They didn't have that. They were like, if you told someone that 20 years ago, they'd be like, you're crazy. I don't have that money. But yet somehow they worked that into their budget because it became a priority to have a cell phone. And I think if it becomes a priority to eat, you know, more wholesome food, there's a way to do that. It just has to become a priority in your life.
Okay. Final question is, can you share with us your fondest food memory?
My fondest food memory.
Cooking or...
Boy, I don't know.
Creating or...
God, I have so many.
A couple.
Okay, let's see. All right, I'll give you a couple. Not cooking or creating, really, but I was at part of a leadership program for one of the companies I worked with, and when we graduated from that, they took us to Napa. And we went to Coppola Winery, Francis Ford Coppola's company, and they took us down. They had set up in the basement of the private Coppola cellars a table for our group, like 15 people, just in the wine cellar. Just Sophia Coppola, his daughter, was being nominated for a Oscar that night. They wheeled in a TV into this old rustic wine cellar. So that kind of was kind of like, what's going on? Oh, well, his daughter is being nominated. So we're eating this, I mean, unbelievable, probably 6-course meal, all locally sourced, you know, drinking the wines and just having a great time. Sofia Coppola wins the, you know, so the place is erupting and it was pretty cool. You know, other food memories. Growing up, we used to go up in summer vacations up to Maine, or we also went down sometimes to more of the Delmarva area or Virginia, North Carolina, and gathering seafood. We used to go out to the rocks and pick mussels and eat them. Down in Virginia, North Carolina, we would put out crab traps for blue crabs and actually catch, you know, 15, 20 crabs and have a big, you know, put the newspapers out on the table, big crab boil type of thing. That was pretty cool. My mom's spaghetti, gotta give mom spaghetti with meat sauce was a classic growing up. Really awesome. As far as, you know, cooking, there's, you know, some big events in my history that I remember doing. We did an event in St. Louis one time for 13,000 people. Three course dinner, salad, stool entree. I think it was like filet and seafood, plus a dessert for 13,000 people. That takes a few days of planning. If you can have a few days of planning,
What do you enjoy most about cooking?
I think I enjoy the creativity of it. I really like the creativity of it. And to be honest, as far as not at home, but in the business, I think I think I enjoyed the camaraderie and the teamwork and almost the adrenaline rush of, you know, because you're always behind in the restaurant business. You're always working, like, to try to keep up, you know. And at the end of the day, you feel like you accomplished something. I mean, you nourished people. There's a very instant sense of gratification, I think, from doing that. And you worked as a team, because there's very few places where you're there by yourself. You know, you have to coordinate a lot of things with a lot of people, and it's almost like an orchestra back in the kitchen of everything coming together. If you're going to have really good hot, you know, not cold, hot comes to the table, beautifully presented. There's so much that went into that, from the producer of every single item to the actual cook that put everything away and stored it in the refrigerators, to the cook that prepped it, to the cooks that are now searing it or, you know, roasting it, whatever they're doing, to the fact that it all has to come together and get plated hot at one time, put up, and then delivered to you. So it's really a lot of moving parts going on in the preparation of food. So I think, you know, I really like that, and it's definitely relaxing to me at the same time, which is hard to believe. It's stressful and kind of a 12-hour day in the kitchen seems like a 3-4-hour day. I mean, it goes by so fast. You know, the last few years, my role has taken me more outside of the kitchen. But I still love when they do let me back in the kitchen. I still do teach classes and do non-credit workshops and that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, I think definitely the just being able to really see the satisfaction on someone's face when you put your heart and soul into what you're creating, and to see the fact that how much they appreciate it.
Can you, just one more question.
Sure.
To someone who does not like to cook or does not sees the value of cooking, would prefer to go to the drive-thru, I mean, how do you convince that person that it's worth going to the grocery store and making that meal?
It's difficult because we live in a world of a lot of competing priorities and families and longer work schedules. And some people, I would say, really, for the most part, it's probably not a reality that they're going to do it. I mean, they're just so busy. But what I would say is you're going to cooking yourself, you're going to get, if you're buying fresh produce, if you're buying decent ingredients, you're gonna get, there's, I don't know, a satisfaction. You're gonna nourish yourself a heck of a lot better. But at the same point, it's a tough argument to make sometimes, because there's nights when I get home and I don't want to cook. You know, it's like the bowl of cereal night, right? We don't do that very often. But I remember my mom used to. She was like, and it's funny too, because my mom's a great cook, but she'd get home after a tired night at 6-7 o'clock, and she was like, give me a bowl of cereal or whatever, and I'm gonna sit and watch the news or whatever. Whereas my dad would get home at 8 o'clock at night, and he'd get the clam sauce going, you know, get the linguine over here. He's chopping his parsley for his clam sauce, and so two different things. But some people, it's never going to be their thing, I don't think, to cook. They're just not going to enjoy it. I think a lot of it is almost a fear of cooking as well. A lack of knowledge of how a few simple concepts or techniques can really expand. I can be that way after 27 years in the industry. Something, if I've never done something and I have it worked up in my head that it's this huge process, and then you do it and you go through it and you're like, that wasn't hard. It was pretty easy. So, I mean, it's not rocket science, and that's what we tell our students. And that's what, you know, my mentors told me growing up. He said, if you're a brain surgeon and you're having a bad day at work, you know, there's some repercussions. You know, if you don't perfectly salt or perfectly season the dish, life goes on. So
Okay. Yeah. One last question. When you're preparing a meal, you said that your heart and soul goes in it. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's, you can taste that when you actually...
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I think you know when somebody puts love or heart and soul into what they're making. You can taste it. You can see it in the preparation. You can see it in the care they put into just putting it on the plate, what it looks like. Did they wipe the rim of the plate, or is it kind of messy? Even in a fast food, for example, I mean, there's times when you just open something, it's perfectly folded, everything looks just fresh, and like, you can tell somebody put, you know, whether it's their pride for doing a good job or what it is, there's a big difference. There's a big difference in it. You can ultimately taste it, in my opinion.
Any final closing thoughts? Anything I missed that you'd like to cover that I didn't?
No, I just think I appreciate the interview, and I really hope we can strive to get closer to a sustainable food system. But I would say for me, it boils down to education, and really, because we have to break some cycles. And the education is not coming from home. It is in some cases, and in other cases, it's just people are stuck in a cycle and don't have the freedom of choice because they either don't have access, be it physically or monetarily, and they don't have the education, they don't have the choice because I don't think they believe that there's a choice, you know, that they can eat nutritious food. Yeah, there's a lot that needs to be done, but.
And how would you start the role of changing the education?
Well, once again, I think I would put it. I would bring curriculum into elementary schools and start right off the bat, educating people about how important it is. Nutrition classes, but it would have to be experiential. There we go. It'd have to be experience learning. You know, it would have to be contextual. They would have to do, you know, so get them physically cooking, get them planting seeds and looking, you know, work that into other aspects of the curriculum. So they're aware of that at an early age, you know, that it's really important that you're able to cook for yourself, that you're able to do these things and not get stuck in the rut of, you know, having to eat fast food all the time.
Do you think it's important, this community... School gardens are important.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think school gardens are very important. You know, coming from an aspect of elementary schools and high schools, definitely. I think, once again, the more we can connect people to the food they eat, the better. I mean, we're just so disconnected right now. And I see it all the time when I go into schools and talk to people, that there's a complete disconnect. And if you... That's just in food, but you mentioned sustainability, or, you know, thinking even beyond that about how it's produced and this and that. There's a absolute disconnect, and so if it doesn't start with the education, and people aren't aware, you don't know what you don't know, you know, and so without that, at least planting the seed, so that they can think of the food system in a different way. And not just accept the status quo as, well, this is what it is. This is what I know. Give them options, at least. You know, I don't believe in telling anyone how to eat or what they should eat. I really don't. But I do believe in creating awareness and of what's out there and what our current system is doing, the implications, and what different avenues that they can go in what they eat. So. I will never say, don't eat this, this is evil, eat this, this is good. There's people out there that will say that. I'm a little bit more middle ground, but I think of creating awareness and educating folks of the different possibilities. Ultimately, it's your choice. It's your body. What you put into it is your choice. You know, I don't necessarily believe in banning 32-ounce sodas, but that's a whole different avenue of food politics, so.
Okay, thank you very much.